5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I'm Mr. Fix-It, he's Diablo Frank, and this is the Spawnometer. Countdown to the cursing and spoiling starts now.
All right, so how are we going to start this?
Well, I personally, like, of all of our themes, and I didn't do anything to it. All I did was cut a sound portion out and throw in a little extra sound effect. But I love the Spawnometer theme. I love that orchestrated, you know, it's such a cranking up, like, dun, dun. It's just so, it's such a big theatrical thing. I dig it.
Okay. So are you going to bring us in? Because I brought us in last time.
Well, yeah, but you can bring us in again.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Spawnometer. I, your friendly Mr. Fix-It here with...
Diablo Frank.
As we Spawnify you all night long. We're going to start with Angela. Sexy ginger of the heavenly universe.
If you're going to spend an entire hour spawning, you'd like to do it with Angela.
Oh, yeah. Like Barry and LaVon. Oh, yeah.
I'm just like Jell-O. I cook and then I chill.
So today we're going to talk about Angela, a Neil Gaiman creation.
Well, there's a bone of contention right there. We'll have to get into that a little deeper later on.
Well, okay. Well, it's a Neil Gaiman creation as far as we're concerned, and the courts were concerned, and Marvel's quite concerned right now.
Well, no, actually, at no point did they say that it was exclusively Neil Gaiman. It was always considered a co-creation between Neil Gaiman and Todd McFarlane. That was never really contested. It was the copyright that was contested.
Oh, okay.
You know, who owned it versus who created it? Because my recollection is that Todd McFarlane was almost entirely responsible for the visuals of the character, and obviously Gaiman was the one who conceived the idea in the first place. They even
Just by reading issue what, 9?
Yeah, issue number 9, March 1993, cover dated.
The miniseries which links to issue
spawned.
9. Yeah, which links the 3, well, actually 4 issue, because it's issues 0, 1, 2, and 3, but 0 wasn't written by Neil Gaiman.
It wasn't a 0, it was a 1 half. I think it was polybagged with an issue of Hero Illustrated. I actually read through the majority of Neil Gaiman's deposition, which was a horrible mistake on my part, because I thought I'd read it in like 15-20 minutes. It's actually up on a website called 20th Century Danny Boy. I wasted several hours of my life reading Neil Gaiman's deposition. I've only managed to scratch the surface of Todd McFarlane's.
That's a rabbit hole you'll never come back from.
Well, I'm coming back from it. I could have just gone with a summation, would have probably been better.
Wait a minute, real quick, before we get into the books. Now, in the Angela series, we're introduced into a world of angels, where all the angels are women. Mm-hmm. Super hot, of every race, and even in that book.
Well, more so in the miniseries. They don't really show that in
Spawn 9.
There's
like Celestra, or... Like, are those characters also owned by Neil Gaiman?
That was actually part of the court case.
Okay.
So,
well, that's why I'm asking you, because I figured you read all that shit it would say.
It's complicated. So we should probably talk about the stories first and then deal with that.
I'm just kind of curious.
It's very complicated.
Well, because, you know, this story ends with Angela becoming...
Well, don't... But we're about to tell them a synopsis. Don't tell them the end of the fucking story. We're about to synopsize.
Just in case you pass away before this podcast release, you want to know the ending. I always read the last page, damn it. So at least I know the end of the story. So we start with Angela.
Yeah, and by the way, the story itself is called Angela, and it's dedicated to the memory of Harvey Kurtzman, who I think passed away somewhere around the time of the release of this book.
Aren't you going to frank me on the person?
You know who Harvey Kurtzman is, right?
Mm-mm.
Mad.
He was one of the guys behind Mad.
And he also did a lot of the really anti-war comics that DC put out back today.
I don't know why.
Timely enough, he actually put out a Playboy competing with cartoons and stuff called Trump. I think it only lasts like an issue or two.
Oh, wow.
Back in the 60s.
We are introduced to a character named Angela, who apparently is a
Well, actually,
hunter.
We're really not in the very beginning. In the very beginning, we're introduced to Medieval Spawn.
No, yeah, because Angela, it's a manual. She's reading a manual off to you of how to properly hunt down.
Well, see, it's kind of an... Okay, so what you actually see is you've got a half-naked woman in the middle of the road, and a medieval era version of Spawn rides up to this woman. You know, hey, maiden, what's going on? And she's like, I'm afraid I'm a maiden no more. Her sister, who's barely more than a child, has been kidnapped by an ogre and taken under a waterfall, and she's petitioning Medieval Spawn for his aid, which he gladly gives. We don't actually know that she's Angela yet.
Okay, but if you notice, these books, especially to this one has a lot of text, which is unusual for a Spawn comic.
Yeah, like you'd have a whole column of text.
Yeah,
and of course it's in cursive to boot.
I'm sitting there, I'm like, damn, I'm doing a lot for a Spawn comic. I'm doing a lot of reading.
Yeah,
it's like a trade worth of writing in a usual McFarlane book. So,
well, if you recall, McFarlane got real fucking wordy around issue 4 of Spawn 2. Though the number of words is not necessarily a testament to the quality of the writing.
True, I will fully agree with that. It says medieval Spawn is then attacked by Angela. She's reading a manual that's basically explaining.
Well, you want to describe Angela?
A ginger goddess, I guess you would say. I mean, I'm assuming a Wonder Woman body type.
Yeah, I mean, she's not as muscular as I think you'd. Well,
no, she is.
More of a classic Wonder Woman. Yeah, I guess okay. Where she's fit, but she's not like cut or anything.
So just Wonder Woman with red hair and really dark goth eyeliner.
Kiss.
No pupils. Yeah, kiss. Yeah, yeah.
No, straight up. She's also got the headband with great big like eagle wings on either side of
very
it.
Very Thor-ish.
But also it recalls an angel's wings because she's Angela. She wears earrings that are the Spawn symbol.
Those are trophies of Spawns.
Right.
Which is stupid because apparently when you kill a Spawn, they turn into a fucking token.
They tell you what a hell Spawn is, that they're creatures that are generated once every 50 to 100 years.
It takes a lot of power to generate them.
Right. And they're given a large but not infinite amount of power.
I do love the fact that they talk about how some Spawns realize their shelf life and freak out and try not to use as much power.
Right.
Because you either become a general of hell or feeding.
They revealed, this was the first time they revealed what happens when the Spawnometer counts down to zero. You go back to hell and you face this challenge. At this point, they face the ordeal of the dark carcass, where they basically have to either prove themselves as being worthy officers in the army of hell, or they're devoured by the minions of hell. The power of the Spawn returns to these hell minions and increases their strength. So the reason why the angels are hunting the hell Spawn and particularly trying to get at them when they're young is prevent that power from returning to the Malbolge,
yeah,
the area from which the hell spawns generate. And when they're young, they're kind of dumb, they're full of cum, they're also somewhat more altruistic. It's encouraged for the angels to take them on before they know what they're doing. You have to kill the bearer of the spawn. The hell spawn is the human host, but you also have what they call the carapace, which is somewhat intermittently referred to as a spawn itself. And the carapace is the shape-shifting suit. After you kill the host, you then have to kill the symbiote, parasite, whatever we want to call the suit, and that's where the token derives from. The token is actually the remaining portion of the suit that survives.
Yeah, anyway, Slame, it turns into a fucking token like Mario. And pretty much. The manual that you're being told gives you better ways on killing a spawn. The lance is seen as the most dangerous way to kill a spawn.
Well, no, it's the only way to kill a spawn, because after you've weakened or destroyed the human host, the suit is still emanating a scrambler that prevents you from actually killing the carapace itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to get in close range to overcome that disturbance and then blast the suit to kill the suit. With this, you got like this energy rod at the bottom of the spear,
yeah,
that destroys the suit.
She kills a medieval spawn. A pretty cool looking spawn. Medieval spawn.
Yeah, with the armored version of the spawn.
Which you could go back and read the miniseries written by Garth Ennis later on.
Well, what's also interesting about all that text too is that it codifies a lot of the assumptions we've had about Spawn. Because there's a bit of, like, we've talked about in the past how there was a bunch of stuff that I assumed was the case about Spawn. It wasn't ever spelled out in the book itself because I derived that from interviews and shit. And Gaiman's the first guy who makes it clear, okay, this is what the suit does. This is what the purpose of the Hellspawn is. That we were giving Alan Moore credit for coming up with Malbolgia. And he almost does, but not quite. He says that the realm that the Hellspawns derive from is the Malbolge. And it's only after Neil Gaiman takes his issue, the demon is explicitly identified as Malbolgia. And that he's the singular demon that is in control of the realm of the Malbolge.
Yeah.
And they repeat the name Malbolgia multiple times in this issue, so that's when it's solidified. But it's funny because it's almost like, with all that text, what Gaiman's really doing is sort of writing like the D&D manual version of the Spawn universe, so you actually have it made explicit a lot of stuff that we've been assuming and that was informed by outside sources, finally making its way into the book in a very clear official handbook of the Marvel Universe sort of form.
The medieval Spawn is killed. We are then whisked away to Al Simmons in the alleyways with all the homeless people.
And you have that one moment where he's dreaming a thumbnail sketch of what's going to happen in the next issue.
The scene
with the arms are reaching through the bars. Yeah.
Yeah. We're then introduced to, what's his name?
The Cagliostro.
Cagliostro, who wants him to create some strawberry wine. Well, first, the homeless people come and tell him, hey, Al, we protected you. The police
cops are around asking questions. After they killed that one fellow, they ran over that one guy. They were pretty pissed off at the cops.
And the mob killed the other guy.
Yeah, so they have an investment in protecting Spawn's closest they see him as their protector and somebody who cares
and
about
And, of course,
them.
It's kind of cool because they do make a point to mention that a certain ex-president, deceased ex-president, Tricky Dick.
Actually, he wasn't deceased yet at that time.
Wasn't he?
They make it out to be that there's a bunch of famous people among the homeless in Spawn Alley. Tricky Dick was one of the guys who
Elvis
was jacking with the
there.
Police the most. Elvis is there.
So he wants to repay them. They're like, no, it's okay. And then we meet Cog.
And Cog actually talks Spawn through the process of creating the strawberry wine from scratch. Wine coolers,
but
really.
But he knows way too much about Spawn's powers.
Yeah, and then until he actually calls Al Simmons, Mr. Simmons by name, that he's like, hey,
yeah.
Wait a second. He's like, the dude just walked you through using your powers and tells you about
and
your
even
suit
tells
and
he'll
him, catch it.
You're not the sharpest tool in the shed, are you?
Like, yeah.
Yeah, not a smart boy. I've literally told you all about your powers.
And you only just now
caught on. You didn't catch
on
until the very end.
I think that was a not too subtle dig at Todd McFarlane himself.
Really?
To be honest with you, yeah.
As they're talking to each other, I believe she walks up as a human form.
Angela.
Hey, you can't.
I know she's in and she's going to see me.
Hey!
How dare you burst into my office like this?
Why wasn't I called about the Hellspawn?
What are you talking about?
You've had me deliberately taken out of the loop.
Angela, really?
Save it, Gabrielle. He's mine.
You're not the only hunter in the universe, Angela.
I've taken out the last two Hellspawns, and I want this one.
You realize it's this kind of behavior that makes it difficult to trust you.
If there's one thing I do well, it's hunt. A lot of people don't like that, including you, but that's not gonna stop me.
Go through the proper channels.
Those channels lead to you. I'm here. I'm talking to you, Ambassador. What about the permit?
Denied.
How long are you going to have it in for me, Gabby? A century? Two?
Follow appropriate protocol, and maybe I'll reconsider.
Just try and keep me out of this, Gabby.
Goodbye, Angela.
Well, yeah. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm skipping it. So Angela comes to Earth, and apparently on the planet Earth, we have a game warden or maybe, or what is she like?
Yeah, Gabrielle.
Yeah, Gabrielle.
So, when they first flash forward to the modern times, they say 800 years later, and you see Angela in a very smart, sophisticated suit, the only thing that really indicates who she is she's still wearing the Spawn earrings, these gigantic, filled-in hoop earrings that are the Spawn symbol. She goes to Gabrielle, who is a white-haired woman. I think she's meant to think that she's older, but she's not drawn with any wrinkles, so she just looks like basically Angela with white hair. These two obviously have an antagonistic relationship, and obviously the white-haired woman is some big muckety-muck at a corporation because they're trying to deny Angela entry, and she's like, no, I'm Angela. I'm getting in here.
No, No. What it is she's, I guess you would say, the ambassador to Earth, where she kind of keeps an eye on what's going on Earth. There's a lot of administrative things she's taking care of, and Angela shows up and says, I'm here to hunt. She kind of laughs her off, pulls out this little, I guess, magic pill or
ball. Glowing, like, BB.
Which is apparently their hunting permit. Tells her to put it up, make it quick. She
yeah,
doesn't
no
like
long-term
Angela very
stalking
much. She's
anything,
not a big
yeah.
Angela fan. They don't like each other. You get that
very
off
clearly,
bat.
Yeah.
And Angela decides to go ahead and start hunting the spawns. Now, again, you can only hunt the spawns on the Earth when they're young. There's a lot of rules.
Yeah.
Because there's an agreement between heaven and hell in terms of...
There's very limited activity between these celestial bodies on the earthly plane itself.
Yes.
They basically have this detente, the ceasefire, where they have limited interaction here and they don't have any interaction elsewhere for the most part. And they're basically, they're both building up their armies for this war to come.
Yes.
Which is another thing that Gaiman contributes, is making clear, well, if there's an army in hell, there must be an army in heaven too, and you don't have an army unless you're preparing for a war.
Yeah,
so,
true.
So that builds the Spawn mythos in a pretty major way there, while still being the logical extension of something that McFarlane had already established.
Angela finds Al. She confronts him. They begin the battle. She's going at him like, I guess she's killed many a Spawn, because she does say several times that she's killed quite a few Spawn.
Well, I mean, it's clear she's gotten at least three kills, because she wears the earrings. The third one is the medieval Spawn, because she collects his deal. And in some version of her,
no,
she's
well, if
shown...
you read Zero, she kills, I believe, pirate Spawn too. So I'm assuming she's been bouncing around here every few hundred years. Yeah. As they're battling, she's doing her usual shtick to take out a Spawn. She thinks she has him on the go. At one point, she believes she's already destroyed Spawn.
His suit is left hanging in the air. It's very much a Silver Age DC kind of thing, where the body of Spawn has disappeared, but the suit's just sort of hanging there like a Looney Tune, and then it falls down onto the ground into the cloak.
And I guess she's going to do what the killing move, where she hits it with a staff and it's supposed to die and turn into a fucking Mario coin. And as she's about to, all of a sudden Spawn's arm reaches out and grabs her and then yanks her into the suit.
Which is funny, because I don't really think of McFarlane being a very sexy artist as far as like trying to draw like cheesecake and that sort of thing. Yeah. But because of the particular angle in which he's pulling Angela down and Angela's lack of much in the way of a costume, he can't help but basically show her ass cheeks and naked legs, very anatomically correct and anatomically detailed. It's like, geez, that's pushing like a PG-13 on this book.
Well, one thing I thought that was really, really strange was, as Spawn yanks her into the suit and he's holding her by the throat, she gets scared and she's like, please stop.
Please don't. Yeah,
please don't.
I can't.
Please. And
which is weird because she's come off as such a
badass.
Fucking badass.
Yeah, dude, so I saw her like, you know, a Terminator. Like, there's nothing that stops her from accomplishing her goal. Yeah.
And a lot of bad attitude, too. Yeah. She's got full of attitude.
I was kind of disappointed because it was almost like they were trying to knock her down a peg.
Well, I think the whole point was the contrast that she's so cocksure in the early stories. And there's obviously something different about this Spawn because he takes her to a place she's never been before and manages to terrify her.
Well, he lets her go.
Spawn apparently has something like the cloak character from Marvel Comics,
yeah,
where you draw somebody into the cape and they're in like this other dimension of darkness. Well, she freaks out so much that she becomes an energy being and flies back to heaven.
Well, no. He's choking her. I guess at the last moment, he releases her. He lets her go because she's scared shitless and she runs like a bat out of hell, shoots out of the suit.
And Cognoscio is like joking. You really see an angel flying like a bat out of hell.
Yes. But she forgets her lance, which is a heavily weapon. Spawn appears, comes out of the cloak.
And doesn't know what the hell happened himself. He like
blacked
out. And
again, Spawn, we haven't really, by this point, haven't nailed down all his powers. So I feel that we're going to be getting new powers quite a bit every few issues.
Pull it out of your butt whenever you need it.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
Get you out of a jam real quick. Like, oh.
And they make it very clear that the Spawn at their peak, and this is a very rare thing, their Spawns are rare to begin with, as noted in this book, but the highest level Spawns, the ones that they rarely achieve a level where they transmutate and shit. They basically have Firestorm's powers where they can alter matter and impact reality itself, which, well, I'm not sure ever gets touched on in any of the Spawn books.
I didn't know it went that far either. Now, this is the weird part because I should have read issue 10. You didn't tell me to read issue 10, but if by reading Angela in the miniseries, they do mention issue 10 between them.
Mm-hmm.
Because in this issue, of course, Spawn finds Angela's lance. He picks it up. He's looking at it. And Cog's telling him, don't touch. Stop. Oh, no. Don't do it. And Spawn's like, there's a button here. Touches the button. He's automatically teleported somewhere else. That's issue 10. I didn't read it. I know the issue, but I didn't read it.
The content of that issue itself isn't really important. Or as far as to the Angela story.
It is because when we get to the Angela series, it actually do kind of mention it.
Well, why don't we go directly into the Angela
series. So right after that,
now,
of course.
But before you do start that, I will point out that the Angela series actually has a lead-in within Spawn number 26. And I was not aware of that. I might have pushed this back some if I was aware of that. But it's really not that important. The main reason why I bring it up is because it is mentioned repeatedly in the deposition. And Neil Gaiman does not have a writing credit on Spawn number 26. But apparently he wrote a little interstitial material that sets up the Spawn miniseries. And in that story, Spawn is once again talking with Cogliostro, who tells him, you're about to disappear and deal with a little intermission right now, and I'll get back to you afterwards. And Spawn's like, what are you talking about? He gets teleported to some frou-frou place like in France or something. It's Gabrielle who's sitting at a table drinking wine and eating strawberries, invites him to do the same, and basically just asks him about his encounter with Angela and asks what happened to the staff. And he explains, I don't know what happened to the staff. I touched it. I disappeared. I went into this weird dream, and then I woke back up again, and the lance was gone. And she said, that's not remotely what happened, but you're sure you don't know what happened with the lance? And he's like, nah. And he's like, you've been very helpful. Thank you very much. You've been very helpful, Spawn. And then he gets teleported back to Spawn Alley and Cogliostro.
And this is issue 26?
Yes.
I can't believe this crap's been going on without me.
Hey, sweetie, didn't I see you in a magazine? Got a boyfriend, Beaver Treat? Somebody to lick away your day? I can do that for you, baby. You want me to show you?
Yeah, show me. Good hunting's where you find it.
Hunting? Oh, we got ourselves some kind of sports babe.
Sorry about this.
Oh, don't apologize, baby. It's all our fault. But it's gonna be fun for us.
I don't think so.
And this one, the story starts out with Angela hunting for her birthday. I think she's,
did they say her age?
150,000 years or some shit like that.
Real old.
Yeah, she's really old.
She's holding up great.
And she's supposed to be a
But before one thing too, I want to talk about, because we talked a little bit about her outfit. Can you go just a little bit more detail in case people don't know who Angela is, so they get a middle picture?
Again, Wonder Woman with orange hair.
Well,
goth makeup, big wing. And since Spawn has chains, she has these ribbons that are constantly protecting her, keeping her warm. almost like a
visually stimulating because
they're twirling around. It's basically Spawn's chains, but you know they're ribbons for.
And I like they have an interesting color scheme because they're kind of like orangey brown and then purple, and then there's some reds in there. That color combination is so unusual that for me it's like a key part of the character. And then she's got the parts where she has armor are golden, but then she has all these white elements, like she has a loincloth thing that's white.
Well, she
and
her reminds actual me of the character when if you've watched Conan the Barbarian and his love interest passes away, and at the very end, whenever he's about to get killed by the brothers, and he comes down with a sword swing, she blocks the sword, and she's dressed like a Valkyrie, I guess you would say,
yeah,
with the goat helmet, the wings, and you know, she tells him,
I have to see that again. One wonders about that. I don't remember what she looked like, but that's
it's very Angela, dude. Like, yeah. I remember, except for the mascara, she has the wings on her helmet, it's almost the exact same helmet. Because I remember when I was reading, I'm like, oh, it looks like the chick from Conan, Conan's wife or girlfriend.
Well, and you have a key bit of asymmetry. Todd McFarlane seems to love asymmetry. She's got that one gigantic cinder block looking boot.
No feet.
Well, there is a little foot thing, but it's like just a little tiny triangle coming out of this great big block of metal, this big hunk of metal that's on her leg. And of course, the staff is woodenish, but then it has this gigantic metal spear.
Wouldn't you say it's more of a spear?
It is a spear, but it's like the shaft is more like a giant hunk of like wood, and then there's just enormous multi-pronged spear tip. And then you also at the back end, it's more flat and blunt because that's where the laser part is. The energy blaster part is. Okay. I just wanted to make sure to get the mental image in there, particularly those ribbons. Okay. By the way, do you like the image of Angela?
I like it, but I just felt like the ribbons was too much.
Costume, I think the ribbons make the suit. I think that's the most distinctive thing about Angela are the ribbons.
But then they're almost exactly the same. It's just you have chains, I have ribbons.
Like, yeah. Well, I mean, the whole point is that she's the opposite of Spawn. She is to heaven what Spawn is to hell.
But again, Spawn has a cape that's alive. His chains are alive. The suit is alive.
Yeah, and she has the
Angela,
ribbons. Yeah.
They never talk about her. Your breastplate's alive. None of that. It's just the ribbons. The ribbons are keeping you warm.
The judge in the lawsuit did make a point of mentioning the ill-fitting bra.
Really?
Yeah. And it's a female judge, and it's like only a female judge would mention that bra doesn't look like it fits her properly. She doesn't. It's not sitting correctly. So tell us about the miniseries now.
So we start out the series with Angela hunting on her birthday, and she got a permission to hunt a special kind of dragon.
Extremely rare giant
like
green dragon.
50 of them in the universe. They're supposedly super dangerous. She's battling the dragon. She smacks it on the head thinking it'll knock it out. Doesn't. She makes the quip about big head, little brain. So when you go for the eye, you got to hope you hit the brain. But again, it's a small target since it's a little brain. Puts her sword through his eye. I don't believe that kills him. I think it angers it even more.
That's the other part too I forgot to mention. She's got a sword and scabbard and the belt is enormous. The belt is like bigger than two of her arms combined. And I thought that was a neat look too because she's pretty much half naked. But then she's got this enormous sword and scabbard.
You got me on that one.
Well, so I remember because the toy was like that too.
Was it?
Yeah.
I don't remember.
It wasn't quite as big, but she did have a great big sword belt.
Well, anyway, so she kills the dragon. I believe she lops off its head. She's collecting her prize when she's confronted by... Now, were those male angels or all female?
No, they were all female, if I recall correctly. But it's hard to tell because there was like 50,000 of them.
Yeah, and they're all in this big armor and you can't really tell. They're all kind of blocky.
She's kind of wobbly because she really had to work hard to kill this dragon.
Dragon, yeah.
So she's looking up at 50,000 angels like... I could still take him, but it's going to be hard. It's going to be tricky. I may not make it out of this one. But she does think about it.
And so...
V-A-L-Y-K-Y. Yeah. Okay, wait. K-Y.
V-A-L...
Well, if you're just trying to show me...
Oh, there it is. Never mind. You're right. See right there. Tell me, am I wrong? We should do a podcast on Conan. Just one episode. Not the movie, but like the character.
When I was thinking about who Angela is, the first thing that came to mind was that she's Red Sonja with Conan's brain.
See, look. She had the fucking big-ass wings on her ears. She's all golden.
Well, she actually had silver-gray armor, though. Yeah, the gold is the light.
Oh, come on. They can't copy it exactly. Not without getting in fucking big ass trouble.
She actually looks more like the comic book Valkyrie that Roy Thomas used to have in his books.
Really?
Like in the Old Thor Squadron, I think it was. She's got a lot more costume than Angela does. She's showing off a lot less skin.
Okay, I just remember.
And she looks like she's kind of got like a furry headband.
I mean, they're not going to copy it
I see similarities. Don't get me wrong. I see similarities. Does Angela have gauntlets? She has like bracelets, right?
Yeah. But the thing is, when I think of Valkyrie from the Marvel comics, she never had ears like that. She never had the Thor ears.
No, agreed. Yeah, I think that might be part of the mythology because the Valkyries that I've seen in some of the DC comics, and actually Brunhild from The Ring, I think also has that kind of headgear.
Oh, okay. My bad. I thought
you might have a better frame of reference. Remember when Elmer Fudd and...
Yeah, yeah. Buzz I know what you're talking about. Yeah. I killed the rabbit.
Yeah. But he had the same kind of fur-lined headpiece too. I don't know if it had the wings though. I don't think it did, right?
No, she did. did when Bugs played the female character. She
oh,
had wings.
Bugs had the wings. Okay.
Because mm-hmm. he had the horns. Because I call upon the thunder, the lightning, and he's striking the earth, and then there's dead Bugs. Anyway, off topic. Angela's then taken into custody. They're referring to her as a traitor because apparently she hunted without a license, which is a huge offense. And that's
or Gabrielle's claiming that she didn't have a license.
Well, true.
That she never saw the hunting permit. So immediately Angela knows it's a frame job.
And her friends, I don't remember their friends' names.
There was a black girl and an Asian girl.
Yeah. And they're
the main reason why I remember them, besides the fact that they were like her stock supporting cast, was I'm really confident that Neil Gaiman was at least strongly alluding to them having lesbian relationships.
Oh,
with
no,
one
she
another.
Is. The black character or the.
It is explicit in the miniseries?
Yeah, they call each other babe.
Well, I don't know if that's necessarily explicit, but you definitely get the vibe.
They allude to it, I think. I don't know. Maybe I've written too much into it.
I think it's strongly inferred, but I don't think it's ever made explicit. Because just saying babe isn't enough. But
you're right.
They have a familiarity with one another that makes it appear as though they have a more than just friendly relationship.
Okay, so next time we hang out with Mac, I want to call him babe. I want you to call him babe the whole night and see what he does.
But girls have a lot more leeway than we have.
Okay, babe. Anyway, so...
Love you too.
Angela is taken into jail. She's presented with her defense attorney, who's this bubbly... She didn't look like them. She didn't look like a badass. She looked like a little attorney. She's only 200 years old.
She's Christine from Night Court.
Yeah.
In the first season.
That's right.
Or no, the third... She was introduced to the second season.
No, because the first one was...
The black woman
was the first one. And then there was the short one with the short pixie hair.
Right, but if I remember correctly, they had Christine
Harry Anderson
pop up on occasion. Yeah, very much so. They had Christine show up in the second season intermittently, and then she joined the cast in the third season.
I don't remember her, because that's when they had a different...
bailiff.
The bailiffs, they changed. Yeah. They went through that pretty fast. Yeah. No, I'm talking about the character Mac replaced.
Yeah, because she was the initial love interest.
Yeah.
Because you had the black female public defender in the first season.
Dan Danfield.
And the love interest was his aide. Both of them left in the first season. So in the second season, you had
Mac,
like Roxy, was it? What was it? She had like this kind of brassy new public defender, and Mac came in as the new aide.
Yeah.
And so the love interest switched over to the public defender. She left after the second season, and then Christine comes in the third season.
Marky Post.
And there's some romantic chemistry with Harry, but they really played more of a long game with that after having had two potential romances fizzle out so quickly between the first two seasons.
True.
Point being is that's got nothing to do with Angela, but she's like Christine.
Yeah.
She's like well-intentioned and bubbly, but she's not really that experienced.
Well, she's only 200 years old, and she's never lost a case. Because this is
she's never had
a case.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
so
Angela,
screaming that this is a setup again.
Her friends, the Angels, decide that they're going to try and prove her innocence by talking to Al, the Spawn.
Yeah, he's going to be their witness. But
his witness, yeah. So they go to a... I don't think they explained her position. The female friend whose life was endangered, and Angela saved her life, and how she won't raise a finger to help her. And she said she will, but she's scared to lose her job. And she's like, who cares about your job? This is Angela.
Yeah, this is a big conspiracy. And you know, she's had your back.
So
you gotta have hers. Yeah.
They're able to find Spawn in his alleyway, as always. They appear and decide to teleport him to heaven, which is called what?
Elysium.
But it's a city in heaven. And his suit is reacting to being there. And he's going into mega defensive mode with all kinds of spikes. And they're like, it's your suit. It doesn't like being here. It's reacting to all the goodness in the air.
I don't know that it's necessarily goodness. It's the enemy. These people are his enemy and it's surrounded by the enemy in their enemy territory.
And it starts to spike up. Like, it's creating these spikes on his body, which is kind of weird. And they say, look, we need you to testify on Angela's behalf. Now, of course, at this time, Al Simmons is still very much human, his mentality. So he's like, sure, I'll do it. Like,
he's also very unaware of what's going on through all the celestial stuff. Yeah.
He doesn't know
any of the shit that's happening in all these different realms and shit.
Yeah, I guess at this time he's still kind of lost with what he has, or in terms of his place
in this universe. He's in a very Jon Snow place right now.
Okay.
You know nothing, Al Simmons.
Damn, we're bringing all kinds of fucking references into this shit. From Night Court to fucking Game of Thrones. Nice. They ask him, can you put yourself in a more presentable manner? So he creates himself into this blonde-haired, super hunk guy, and they're going toward the trial. To the trial. At which point, we get there, and they're interviewing Gabriella, and she's talking about how Angela just showed up, didn't have permission, just went straight to hunting.
Gave her lance to the Hellspawn.
Yeah, trying to make her sound like a traitor. That it was all a ruse, that she actually was trying to give him a weapon, and painting her the villain that's betraying all of them. And there's a little bit of cat fighting back and forth between her and the attorney.
Well, there's one thing, too, they make it clear in the miniseries. Angela's rubbed a lot of people the wrong way.
Oh, yeah, she's very cocky. cocky.
She's very aggressive. She does put
not even cocky. Wants. She's arrogant.
Yeah, very arrogant. And so she's made a lot of enemies in this place.
Yeah, and they allude to that quite a bit. There's a lot of people that hate her. They dropped the word bitch quite a few times. I was a little shocked it was in there. They show up and they tell Christine, we have him here. So she presents Al Simmons to the court. As soon as she shows up, suit goes full spawn, trying to protect him because I guess he's surrounded by it in a courtroom full of angels. The suit goes crazy. Immediately, the judge says, kill it, kill it, kill it. Guards, kill it.
He tried to
kill
it.
And he's like, I'm here to testify. He's like, he's still in that mindset that I'm just here to help someone. Not realizing like, no, dude, you don't understand. You're on this chessboard. You are the opposing force. There's no one in this room that cares about what you think you're doing. They're all here to kill you. They're attacking him. He's defending himself. Angela's like, I don't want to get involved. I just want to, you know, let this go.
If I get involved in this fight, I'm fucked.
Yeah.
I'm definitely going to be confirming that I'm the traitor based on Gabrielle's false testimony.
I feel the guilt that she had from whenever Spawn bested her, got the best of her. Like, she owed him because he let her go. He didn't have to. He could have killed her in the suit.
Maybe. I think there was more situation where she was already kind of, you know, ready for a fight.
I think she
realized the odds were against her anyway.
She definitely had a sense of honor where she's like, I mean, think about it. When he had her in the suit, she's like, please. The last word she says to him is please.
Mm-hmm.
He had her dead to center. He didn't have to let her go. He could have killed her. She knew that, but he let her go. And I guess in a warrior
sense.
I
think it's more ambiguous than that.
I think Gaiman wrote it like she has a code. You save me, now I got to save you. Because she goes in there to defend him, to help him escape. They're jumping around. They're, you know, they're trying to get away.
They're fighting their way through this celestial city.
They jump through a wall. As they're dropping, she's telling them to teleport them out. At this point, I think they have like sharpshooter angels, like aiming weapons at them. And as they teleport, one of them takes a shot and I believe hits the suit, right? Or hits the cape.
Yeah, there's a bit of cape floating and everybody assumes that they're old, that they're both
dead. They're disintegrated. Yeah, they're dead. Now, at this point, we're immediately sent to, I guess, this angelic form who's speaking to Mount Bulger, talking about how they've broken the truce. And Mount Bulger's like, I haven't broken the truce. I haven't done anything wrong. She goes, well, there was a spawn that showed up on our doorstep. How do you explain that? And he basically tells her, look, if I'm going to break the truce, it's to my benefit when I'm ready to do it. I'm not going to do it yet because I'm not ready. Basically, telling him that he's going to fuck him over, just not today.
Mm-hmm.
And so he does this quick mental run through and he goes, nope, everybody's here. He goes, except we can't find the spawn from Earth, Al Simmons. If you got him, keep him. He's an asshole. I can't deal with him anymore.
Because
mm-hmm. he does come off kind of fucking whiny, like, why me? What am I going to do?
Well, and I think, even at the this is a couple of years into the Spawn book. Unfortunately, I don't like to jump ahead too much, but I think that they've already had some run-ins in the meantime.
Well, they do talk about how in the book, at the very beginning of the issue, Al's like, oh, Wanda, I can't bother Wanda because she got Terry. And Terry and her got a baby. Oh, I miss her. And he's just whining and whining and whining. The devil gives you powers and all you're going to do is bitch and whine and go all goth and emo. It's a little annoying. He expected him to be this great soldier that he was when he was human form. And all he is just a big baby whining and bitching about Wanda. Did they teleport to hell?
They're in some weird in-between place. Okay,
that's what I thought. Like limbo?
Kind of a limbo. But apparently this limbo does connect to a realm in the Melbolge.
Okay. So there's these little creatures that are spying on Al.
They're actually
Angela.
Very cute little demon thingies. One's a little furry guy who has a funny little variation on Yoda speak.
Yeah, and then there's like some kind of creepy clown doll girl and like these little creatures. They're talking about being in the castle and do you remember any of the dialogue between them? I'm trying to remember. Between Al and Angela.
It's some vacated castle from some dude that got killed. There was some big mucky muck in this hell
there's
place.
There's a war. There's a gate because they're asking,
right.
Well,
everybody's afraid.
Here?
Everybody in hell is afraid of this castle because the castle is basically hell haunted. Yeah. So if somebody from hell goes in there, they just fucking disappear and get lost.
What was the
and
name of that little creature?
Spawn and Angela come out of that place.
The little creature's name was like Slut or Scum or the little creature that's telling.
I think maybe something like Scum. Like it's been a few months since I read
some really weird name. Yeah.
Smut.
But that creature tells him that, you know, there's a gateway out of here. It's up there at this doorway. But there's two armies battling. They've been battling for 2 weeks now, and the war should die down in about a week. And I was like, fuck that. We out of here.
Well, you missed a key part, though. In between those things happening, Angela and Spawn get it on.
Okay, was that it? Because I think he just
they
kept
have,
her
they
warm.
They have the sexual relations,
He says, are you cold? She goes, yes. And then she goes, now I'm warm. I don't think he brought out the rod
shock. In comic books, when everything goes black and somebody blows out a candle and I was cold, but now I'm warm. They had the relations.
I think you're reading too much of that.
First they had the relations and then she starts bitching him out after the relations. So I don't think Spawn Fallon was laying that good D.
I think you're reading into it. I think she was cold.
I think it's been explicitly stated that they had the Sexons.
No, I think you're reading too much into it.
Okay, we're going to agree to disagree on that. But then they start bickering with each other, and that's when they're discovered. No, because they're naked. They were naked when the demon things found them.
I don't remember that.
If I recall correctly, they're found in a state of undress, and they have to kind of gather themselves once they become aware of the little demon thingies.
Okay, that just seems really weird, but that kind of fault.
It was very weird pacing. It was very arbitrary. It was very much the author's hand, where suddenly these guys are going to get the fucking on when they're in limbo.
Well, I'll admit, look, the first issue was good. The second issue starts kind of wavering, and then by the third issue, I think they really lost where they were going with it, and just it really came out to an abrupt ending. Like there was.
Well, it's just like, okay, it was very much an episode
of a TV show. The way they wrap up everything at the very end, real nice and tight. I didn't particularly care for it.
But yeah,
I was really surprised because it's gaming too.
Well, I mean, they leave the castle and they have a big fight with the minions of hell between these two armies, and then what happens?
They're taking weapons from them. She takes a sword, he takes an axe. They're hacking away.
Well, they fight their way to a doorway or
something.
Yeah, the doorway out of there.
They accidentally take the little creature with them. We'll call him, I guess, scum or jizz. I don't remember what his name is.
Smut and nothing but.
And they take him with them, and they jump through the portal. And because they jump through the portal, this is the weird part, each of them go back to their original beginning. So Spawn lands in the alleyway, and Angela's sent back to heaven. As she's sitting there in heaven, her girlfriends are in her room talking about how sad it is that she's died and gone, and how they miss her, and like there'll never be another Angela. At this point, she's taking a bath, because the whole time during the book, she's covered in blood from the dragon. Never cleaned up once. That's why I don't think they had sex, unless Spawn's in some really dirty shit. But she's covered in blood, dragon blood. So she's taking a bath. They're doing the remembrances of her, and she pops up in the room and's like, well, I'm glad I'm not gone, or some weird term about her not being gone. The girls are all excited that Angela's back. They apologize first for bringing the Hellspawn, because they didn't realize that it was going to go sideways so fast. They decide that they're going to go back. This was the part I really did not like of the story. So Angela decides, I'm going to go back to Earth. I'm going to confront Gabrielle. And Gabrielle's sitting there, and she's like, I'm still alive. She puts a sword to her head. She goes, you're going to confess. And she goes, confess to what? She goes, you're going to confess what happened. How did this happen? Like, how did y'all make everything disappear? She alludes that whenever Spawn touched the lance, he was teleported somewhere. And when he was teleported somewhere, all records of her arrival disappeared automatically. And not only that, but any proof that she was there to hunt was gone as well. And there was no record on heaven or earth of her arrival. And also that the lance had vanished. No one could find it because they'd been looking for it for already months. And so she took it as an opportunity time to basically get rid of Angela. And she said, why would you want to do it? She goes, I hate you. Like, you know, bitch, I hate you. It just came out, you know, just there was no real motivation except she's hate and jealous, I guess. And Angela's like, okay, well, I want you to turn yourself in. And she's like, why? No. And then Angela kind of laughs at it and says, well, goodbye. And it teleports out. Gabrielle calls in the guards. Where are the guards? Send them in here now. I don't need a reason. Just send them in now. The guards come running in. And then you find out that Angela had a tape recording on her. And I was just like, oh, that's so fucking lame. That's how we're going to end the story, that you recorded the conversation after you threatened her with a sword. Yeah, that's going to work out real nice. Christine tells her that she's going to send in the tape to the authorities and that she can come back to heaven. And Angela's like, fuck that. I don't want to go back. I'm done. Like, you know, I'm a good soldier. I'm a good carrier, I guess she is. Like, she carries things from heaven wherever they need it sent to. Yeah. Courier, there you go. That she's done. She's not going to return to heaven. She wants nothing to do with them. She's going freelance. And they're all freaking out. You're going freelance. She goes, you know, they make the point of, oh, no one's ever done that before. And she's like, well, I'm the first. I'm going to be the first. And then I guess she talks to her other two female angel friends to go ahead and jump ship with her. But Christine decides to stay behind, which makes Angela happy to know that they have a friend in the inside. Then we get to the end of the book where another angel is confronting Gabrielle about saying how the tape arrived. It's her confession. It's showing that she lied and that she has to go speak to the bosses. And, you know, that there's going to be some big changes. She calls in the guards. The guards come in. She's letting the guards know there's going to be big changes in that office. And then we're sent back to the original planet, which started the series, where Angela goes and finds the dragon head, which has now been picked clean by the local, I guess, creatures. And she's collecting her trophy, and she's kind of like, happy birthday to me. And then that's it. Yeah. I just felt like that was just such a weak ending.
Yeah. So coming into this, what background did you have on Neil Gaiman? Because you read this when it came out, right?
Yeah.
So where were you at with Neil Gaiman at that point in time?
I think I had read one or two Sandman books, and that was about it at the time.
Like the trades? You remember which ones?
Dream House or House of Dreams?
Dolls House.
There you go. And I started the second one. Was it Nocturnal?
Preludes and Nocturnes. Yeah. You flipped it, though. Preludes and Nocturnes is the first one, and then A Doll's House is the second one.
Damn dyslexia. But yeah, that was, I think, the first one I had read all the way through. I had bought it at Cubed, I think. And the second one I had just started. But I remember really enjoying the first one.
This is the one that's in the house with
Death.
Dream
being trapped.
Art by Sam Keith and Mike Dringenberg. Yeah. And it's the 1920s, and he's trapped for most of the American century in this,
and no one can sleep. By
this Aleister Crowley type dude. Yeah.
Fucking fantastic book. And I remember.
Whereas for me, I read A Doll's House, and I loved that, and I wasn't as into Preludes and Nocturnes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I just remember reading it, and I really liked it. And again, when I saw his name, I was like, well, I mean, I just read that. I really enjoyed that. So I had a good feeling about this book. I'm a little disappointed, but okay.
Now, you'd read Spawn 9 before the Sandman stuff, though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, for me, I'd been hearing the buzz about, not necessarily Neil Gaiman, but about the Sandman series, but I didn't have access to a comic shop. And I finally was on my brother's side of town and went to his shop, and I bought, if I remember correctly, the last chapter of Season of Mists, which would have been well into the 20s by that point. And being that it was the last chapter of an extended story arc, I didn't know what the fuck was going on. But Kelly Jones did the art. I think he did the art, or it might have been Dringenberg, maybe a combination. I liked the art, and I liked the sense of what the book was. And then I managed to score a few more issues that were part of the anthology series of one-off stories called Distant Windows. And I really, really enjoyed those. I enjoyed them a lot. And then I ended up carrying the series once I moved to Colorado and I had access to a comic shop. I became a regular Sandman reader. I went back and I bought The Doll's House and then eventually Preludes and Nocturnes. And it completely blew my mind. It was a huge moment for me as a comic book reader. Neil Gaiman basically made me think about the writing of comic books in a way that I never had before. He revealed to me the possibilities of what could be done with comics as a medium. It's one of the reasons why I'm not a big Alan Moore fan, is because, again, other people got to me sooner and stronger, and Gaiman was definitely one of those people. I do think that the Sandman series never quite got as good. So I came in around the time where the book was starting to take a dip in quality. Yeah, it pretty much declined for the whole rest of the series. But I so fell in love with Gaiman because of that first year, that honeymoon year with him and his work. I would read anything that Neil Gaiman had his hands on in that time period. So of course I stuck around for the Spawn Rider series. I bought the Angela miniseries when it came out. And I'd also bought Alice Cooper's The Last Temptation of Alice when that was around. I was buying the Sandman series right up to the end. I'm trying to think of some of the other stuff he did. Oh, I bought in big on fucking techno comics. You know, I was definitely like a series, like I was trying out my universes at that time period. After I left reading Marvel and left the X-Books, I was trying a ton of different universes. I read DC, I read Dark Horse Comics Greatest World, I gave Valiant a whirl, and then I bought way too many goddamn techno comics, mainly because of Neil Gaiman, because he was the creator of two of their series, and as you may recall, Techno Comics was always Leonard Nimoy's Primordials, Isaac Asimov's iBots, Neil Gaiman's The Pneumatic Man. And so I bought like the first year of The Pneumatic Man. I bought some Technophage comics. I think I bought Lady Justice. And I got to tell you, after reading all those books, and he didn't write them, by the way. He came up with the concepts. I think a fellow named Ted Slapyak was the one who was writing the actual books with his name on it. And I think C.J. Henderson may have written Lady Justice. And it was all bleh. You know, and the techno comic, if they'd been outright horrible, I wouldn't have kept up with them. They were just bleh. But because of Gaiman's name, I bought them all. I can't remember a goddamn thing about most of those series that I was reading. All that shit that I bought with Gaiman's name on it, including...
Didn't they have the character Ruin?
Rune. Rune was Ultraverse.
Oh, okay, my bad.
Yeah.
Because I remember Primal. Leonard Nimoy's Primal.
I think it was Primordials, wasn't it?
Like dinosaurs, right?
Bipedal dinosaur creatures and stuff, yeah. All those techno comics, bland shit. The intention was that I think sci-fi or some similar group had invested in comics at the exact wrong time. They came in during the bust, bought deep into that stuff, and none of it was memorable. The best of the books of all things would have been Mickey Spillane's Mike Danger, which was written by Max Allen Collins and drawn by Eduardo Barreto. That was the only one of those series that I halfway liked, and that was just a private eye story with a little bit of sci-fi element mixed into it. But at least that one was an entertaining read for as long as I stuck with it. As much as I love Neil Gaiman, in that mid 90s time period, it just seemed like he was cashing all the checks and not doing any of the work for that stuff. And in rereading this Angela material, I very much feels like paycheck work from him as well. Yeah. But at the same time, it's obviously important in comics history, and especially in Image Comics history. It adds mightily to the Spawn mythos, because it's one of those weird things. It's like, obviously, if you've got a guy who's in Hell's army, Heaven's got to have an army too. And what does Heaven look like? And Gaiman being someone who likes women a lot and who's close friends with, or was close friends with, Tori Amos and shit, it would make sense that he would want to have a woman. And in fact, you know, with that red hair, Angela's not completely dissimilar from Tori Amos. Yeah. One wonders about that. If you need me, me and me will be hanging out with the Dream King. There were several things that sold Neil Gaiman on doing this. One is that he found out about the involvement of Alan Moore, who he's friendly with. He actually calls him up on the phone and shit. And the involvement also, he'd be put in the same category with Dave Sim and Frank Miller, since he was going for those four guys. He did it because McFarlane sold him on creators' rights and sticking it to the corporations, and told him, you know, whatever deal DC can give you, I'll do better. I'll give you a better deal. You'll be happy with me. And, you know, the money, it doesn't hurt.
Yeah.
Ultimately, all four of the writers and the writers series was cut a check for $100,000 for their one issue.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, each of them got $100,000. In the case of Neil Gaiman, he'd done the math, and in particular, he'd pointed out that he had put out, I think it was either the Sandman 50th issue or the Sandman special that they came out with the glow-in-the-dark cover, and that had sold somewhere in the neighborhood of 250,000 copies. And so based on his royalty share, that was equivalent to what he would have gotten for that. But the thing is, the Spawn issue, you may recall Spawn, the big thing with Spawn is it sold somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 million copies and became the biggest independent comic book of all time.
Yeah.
By the end of the initial run of McFarlane written stories, it had dropped to about 600,000 copies per issue. The Alan Moore issue sold 1.2 million copies, and the Neil Gaiman issue sold 1.1 million copies. And so Gaiman is correct in that if you do the math on his Sandman issue for what he earned on the Sandman issue, he got somewhere in the neighborhood of $25,000 for that. So if you multiply that by four times, it'd be about $100,000. Mm-hmm. But Neil Gaiman wasn't going to sell a million fucking copies. So it was funny because in Gaiman's mind, that was fair based on his royalty share at DC, but Neil Gaiman wasn't selling a million copies at DC. So that was an issue where reading through the deposition, it's like, hey, asshole, you wouldn't have done that without Spawn's name on the cover, Todd McFarlane's artwork. He was still selling 600,000 copies, which is still twice what you did on Sandman. But he took a large degree of credit for the bump in sales, not unearned. Alan Moore doubling the sales of Spawn and Neil Gaiman continuing that trend is remarkable, and obviously a great deal of credit goes to them. I would not have continued to read Spawn without those writers, and I'm sure that there were a ton of Sandman fans in particular that bought, if only that one issue, bought that issue. Also, a lot of people wanted to read Alan Moore's first superhero work in a number of years, because I think Alan Moore, after Watchmen, did not do another superhero book until Spawn. He tried to form his own comic book company, Spider Baby Graphics or something, and he had done an anthology series, I think it was called Asylum, maybe? And he was doing From Hell. He was serializing From Hell with Eddie Campbell on that. And he was making no goddamn money. And so Todd McFarlane showing up with a $100,000 check, including a $10,000 advance before the issue had even been written yet, was money that Alan Moore desperately needed, mm-hmm. and I'm sure helped to fund the entire production of From Hell. So Alan Moore returning to superhero comics, returning to mainstream comics, was a big fucking deal. And obviously the writer series was heavily promoted, where they would just be a black page in the previous catalog, a Spawn symbol, and Alan Moore writes Spawn 8. Neil Gaiman writes Spawn 9. So there's some very canny marketing there. Mm-hmm. And the whole point, one of the things that that Todd McFarlane used to sell creating these comics was that all his buddies at Image were doing foil covers and embossed covers and thermal reactive covers. And he felt that the best gimmick that he could have would be great writing. And he had been taking so much shit for his writing, and the Image guys had been taking so much shit for their writing. Although he also pointed out quite rightly that he wasn't getting as much shit at Image. The main place he got shit for his writing was on Spider-Man. In fact, Neil Gaiman points out that the first time he heard Todd McFarlane's name was he was at the DC offices and somebody had brought up the first issue of Spider-Man number one, and everybody was laughing at how it was clear that the person who wrote the book had never written anything before. And mocking it. But McFarlane had done over a year on Spider-Man and had gotten better over the course of that series. I recognize that, and all my friends when we were reading Spider-Man recognized that. I believe you've acknowledged that as well. And so by the time he did Spawn, people weren't shitting on McFarlane so much, but they were shitting on everybody else, especially Liefeld. It was very important to Todd McFarlane that Image Comics succeed. It was very important to him to get some name brand writers at Image to show that it wasn't just an artist company. But also, I think that there was that competitive spirit between the Image founders where McFarlane felt that the best gimmick he could come up with, the thing he would really show what Image could do and kind of stick it to his buddies and show that he still knew what, was to get these great writers to come on and shoot the sales of Spawn through the fucking roof.
Well, here's something fun. When I was doing some research for this issue, Todd McFarlane was the last guy to go digital at Image Comics.
As far as like offering his books digitally?
He tried to stay as loyal as he could to the brick and mortar buildings to the very end, I think till 2015, when it was just the demand for digital was too high. And I believe in the year of 2015, he put the entire Spawn collection on digital.
Yeah.
But up to that point, he did. And he was trying to support back issues and things of that nature.
We give Todd McFarlane shit, and I think rightly a lot of the time. But I think he is not just an opinionated guy, but he's a principled guy. And I think he's a very loyal person. He believes in personal loyalty. And I do think he feels a great loyalty to the retailers that have kept Image going all these years. And I think he has a very realistic opinion that digital shit just helps pirates. When you offer a superior digital copy of a comic book, it makes it that much easier to distribute and makes it that much more desirable to just pick up the digital copy, whether acquired legally or illegally. And that ultimately, money doesn't find their way into local hands and it doesn't find its way into his hands. He's right about that. But I do respect that he recognized the danger in digital, and I respect that he was loyal to comic shops for as long as he was. As I've said before, I loved Neil Gaiman. I got burned by him many, many times. I have enjoyed some of his work as a writer, like an author, and some of the adaptations.
I was really disappointed
same
with American Gods.
You really liked American Gods?
No, I was really disappointed with it.
Oh, were you?
Yeah, the ending was really weak.
Oh, yeah?
I haven't seen the series yet. I want to see the series. I was very intrigued by the book. I enjoyed most of the book, but again, when we got to the end, it was just kind of like, ugh.
I really like Coraline.
Oh, he wrote Coraline? Oh, I didn't know that.
I love the movie adaptation specifically, but I've enjoyed a lot of his stuff, and I respect his impact on comics. I do think he has a pretty big ego. I do think that he's one of these guys that feels like he's too good for comics now, possibly rightly so. But the fact that there's been so little that he's written in comics that I've enjoyed since the early 90s really pisses me off, and it makes me feel like he's not really trying necessarily. But he's got a number one bestseller right now. When I was flipping through the Entertainment Weekly, you picked up. He's got a book on Norse mythology that's a number one New York Times seller. So.
Yeah.
And I am kind of interested in that too. I acknowledge that he's a great writer, but he's got a lot of ego. I like that in his deposition, he makes a point of pointing out, I'm one of the most revered writers and most critically acclaimed writers in the entire medium. It's like, okay, settle down, Neil. As far as the Angela miniseries, I thought it was all right. I liked the Angela character concept. The art in that miniseries was by Greg Capullo, and I was a Capullo fan at that time. I agree with you. I thought it ended in a flat manner, and they didn't do a
thud.
Time for another spawning ground.
I hate the mail.
I know you hate the mail. That's why I have to do all the reading.
I hate the mail.
Okay, so this is the part where I'm going to remind myself to check Facebook because I haven't recorded that stuff yet because I have to log on to Facebook and I hate doing that, especially these days. That would be Allie Batts, Derek William Crabb, Joe Crawford, Ryan Daly, DeBeige, Gene Hendricks, Keith Mason, Clinton Robinson, Max Romero, and Scott Rowland. Also, sorry for the abrupt ending to the Angela segment. It was running way too long. We cut over 20 minutes out of the back end. We'll address some of that stuff in a later episode. I've neglected to acknowledge Tumblr. So we've gotten likes in recent episodes from Berserker 200, Lady Hawk Things at Vermissen Stern Page, Rebellions, Angels, and Zegas, which is Michelle Fife. Grant Richter writes, I'm playing fast catch up with Spawnometer and I'm loving it. These books didn't resonate with me when they were originally on the shelves, but I have mad respect for contribution the Image founders, especially Rob Liefeld. As far as the Twitter acknowledgments, they include 108 Sage, Allie Batts, Andre Reyes, Andy Roach, Backseat Directors, Biko Django, Bone Dragon Comics, Bones Cafe, Cash Flag, Chris at Bad Books for Beginners, Chuck Forsman, Dr. Gene Nerdologist, DragonFan.net, Ed Moore Jr. at Miskatonic and Teal Productions, Ava Zarneka Art, Fanholes Podcast, Gavin Higginbotham, who I believe is the continuity cop for the Savage Dragon comic book official, Graphic Novelism, The Hammer Strikes, Hashtag Fan Art, History of Comics on Film, It's Plastic Man, Jeffrey Brown, Joe Crawford, Justice First On, Christatos, Kyle Benning Likes Comics, Longbox Crusade, The Man on the Wall, Merch, Nethead, Odell Abner Dracula, Rad Adventures Podcasting Network, Ryan Daly, Secret Wars and Beyond Podcast, Sean Phillips, Siskoid, Steve Sellers, Superhero Speak, Unearthly Visions, and WordPress Command and mind control. Unearthly Visions also adds, all the talk about martial law makes me want an episode of Under Guides dedicated to at least the original miniseries.
Absolutely.
We need to. It just hadn't worked out yet. Mac, I think, has committed to reading the first miniseries, but he doesn't have it in his possession, to my knowledge. So
I thought you had to facilitate that. No, you handed him a trade copy of it.
I did, but I thought he gave it back to me. I'll have to check. Justice First Dawn writes, awesome. Aside from the Liefeld books, Savage Dragon was the main image title I stayed with for years. Odell Abner Dracula notes, this episode will help me cope with my 4-hour flight home this weekend. Thank you. Mac on our Facebook page put the image that we discussed at length involving the Super Patriot exquisite crotch.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the exquisite cyber taint, as I put it.
I believe he was more cock than brains.
And she writes, this image deserves a good discussion. And then in a perhaps unrelated note, Mary C. Clegg wrote, never ride on a steam engine. Go nowhere fast, but the sensation is exhilarating. I like to assume that's related to the Super Patriot image. Ryan Daly wrote, I've lived a long life free regret, but I do wish I'd read more Savage Dragon in my life. I only really remember the issue with the cyborg Super Patriot, which I thought looked awesome. Superhero Speak writes, really enjoyed this episode, and wow, thank you so much for that cool ad you cut for us. We really appreciate it. By the way, if you guys like Savage Dragon, you should check out our review with Eric Larson. I need to put that on the webpage. They sent us like an image of Will Smith fake crying on a talk show over his joy at the ad that I cut together right quick. Also, a link to the podcast they put out with Eric Larson. DragonFan.net also thanked us for the mention. Jeffrey Brown left us a series of tweets which involved a lot of images, which you'll be able to see on the website. He writes, I got this miniseries. I first saw the cartoon as a kid. Much later, I bought the single issues 1-3. And later in my teens in 08, I bought this trade. I just love the characters and the world he lives in. I reread this book a lot. Right now, it's the first 50 issues in archive editions. The characters in Savage Dragon that have interested me since I had seen the cartoon was Overlord. On the cartoon, he had an awesome voice, I thought. And I liked the later version with the cape and the more Kirby-looking tech. Mako, I remember from the cartoon in Basher 2. But upon reading this the first time way back in 08, I was surprised that Basher got killed so early. His cartoon lived a lot longer than the comic version here. And the brutality of Arachnid eating people, which in the cartoon was only implied. I still love that cartoon. As a kid, I was obsessed with Savage Dragon. Yeah, it is funny though. Basher dies in his second appearance in the comic.
Yeah.
And then in the cartoon, I think he's in there throughout. He's definitely all over the... I've only watched the pilot episode in recent memory where I can actually recall something. And Basher's in a good chunk of that. So
they mention Arachnid in the cartoon?
Savage Dragon fights him in the very first cartoon.
I've never seen any of the cartoons.
You've never seen it at all?
No.
They're mostly available illicitly online.
Again, when it came out, it was on what, USA? On Saturdays?
Right.
And it was like the Image Hour, where it was that and Wildcats.
Wildcats was on CBS. So unless it is a rerun.
I remember wanting to watch Savage
Dragon,
but never
Savage Dragon
it.
Was like Street Sharks or something like that. It was part of a block of programming because at one point they had an episode where they all crossed over, maybe Street Fighter, all intermingled, and God, that's a rights issue, not unlike Ready Player One kind of situation.
Wow. But nope, I've never got to see a full episode.
I will say though, Basher's clearly black in the comics and he's pretty white in what I've seen of the cartoons. Kyle Bedding also has a really involved post. The few issues I've read, I've regretted that I didn't spend the time doing something else instead. Most negative I ever was on my show was reviewing a Savage Dragon Free Comic Book Day episode. It was also the most heavily downloaded episode I ever put out. I guess I should have gone negative more. My problems with the Dragon were that the issues I sampled were inaccessible to new readers. That's on me for issues from the ongoing, but that's on Larson for a Free Comic Book Day issue meant to hit new readers and entice them to try the book. I must have missed some of Kyle's comments too, because there was also a side discussion about the animosity between John Byrne and Eric Larson, how those guys have been kind of at war with each other for a number of years, in the same way that I just can't enjoy his art style. I think I like a diverse array of styles, but Larson's gritted teeth and shading to cover up anatomy and detail never worked for me. To me, he will always be the guy who got famous for trying to draw Spider-Man like McFarlane. There's times I try to listen, watch documentaries and interviews with him, especially about his Kirby influences, but those often to me seem to be hijacked by suggesting that he is Kirby's self-appointed heir. My favorite comic creator is John Byrne. Obviously, Byrne and Larson have bad blood. I've seen Larson try to completely discount Byrne's contribution to the medium, which is hard for me to rationalize when in my eyes, Byrne's worst drawing is a million times better than Larson's best. I don't align myself with any political party, and so I don't mind political trolling as long as it is aimed at the politicians themselves, since they are the true a-holes in all of this. A few thousand morons aside, I'd like to think most common people in the world are still decent folk. I have often wondered if portraying groups of people as one-note straw men in media has led to our divisive culture we have now, where everyone views someone with a different opinion as a vile villain that must be stopped. Real people are more complex than that, except racists, which do still exist and are absolutely awful. But the very visible display of their presence, I think, has got people suspecting everyone different than them may be insert a politically charged insult here, when I truly hope that is not the case. But all I can rely on is what I witnessed firsthand. Iowa is small. It's a swing state that rotates between red and blue. Not that anyone really cares after that first caucus. And everyone here, for the most part, seems to be pretty decent regardless of their leanings. Your mileage may vary. What were you saying about weeds earlier, Frank? So yeah, we kind of got in the weeds there. Yeah, and I was also doing a little back and forth with him on Twitter.
That
was...
I'm just happy we found your soapbox, Frank. I thought it was lost, but someone else had borrowed it. The rolled spine soapbox.
Well, here's one thing, too, that drove me nuts is, you know, I was looking for audio clips for the Savage Dragon episode that weren't from the cartoon, and I happened upon a commentary where somebody had decided to pick up the Trump issue that I showed you, and the dude spent a half hour just ripping it to shreds, and it was apparent very, very quickly that he was a Trumpkin, because he's like, oh, man, I had a look at Eric Larson's work in years. It's so terrible now. He's such a terrible artist now, going after our president and blah, 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 and it's like, you're really pissed off that he went after Trump. It's not a new thing. He's been a liberal the entire damn time. Yeah. If you read his comic, his politics are pretty much right there on his sleeve, but you're only just now really pissed off about it because you're all of a sudden hypersensitive because you really, really love
your
candidate.
Very thin-skinned because...
They're very thin-skinned. Listening to that guy just troll the shit out of Eric Larson for no good reason, because personally, I really like the artwork in that Trump issue. I thought it looked really nice, and while I enjoyed the flashy art that Eric Larson had back in the late 80s, early 90s, particularly on Savage Dragon and Spider-Man, not so much the stuff he did over at DC, it was kind of rough then. He was still kind of defining his style. But I actually like Larson among the better of the artists, especially in retrospect. I wasn't as into that cartoony look when I was younger, but as an adult going back and looking at his work, I really enjoy how individual his style is. I like his particular look, but I think also when he does more realistic stuff as he did with that Trump issue, it looks very nice. And in truth, I enjoy it more than most of the Image founders as far as what he's doing today versus, you know, what some of the other Image founders are doing today.
Oh no, the thing about his style is it's very consistent. Like, it's consistent and it grows. No, it's evolved, but it's
definitely evolved a lot. Yeah.
If you see a page of his artwork, you know it's Eric Larson.
Yeah. Yeah. Recognizable.
There's a lot of artists out there. I've seen artists that I thought it was McFarlane and it wasn't. We don't say copy. They were able to emulate this art style very close to the original.
There are a few Larson clones out there, though. I want to say, I can't remember. I think his name was Corey Hampshire. He did work for Larson and he very much was doing a Larson riff where he looked like he did like Mighty Man and stuff. And I just assumed it was Larson. So there are some Larson guys out there that
I saw some artists that I thought it was Capullo and it wasn't Capullo.
Yeah.
McFarlane. Layfield, let's be honest, just draw two straight lines and you've copied him. But like other stuff.
You're always so bad on Layfield. You got to be saying Layfield. It's Layfield.
Layfield. Anyway, but his style is very. I just finished reading his Savage Dragon and Martial Law just because we were talking about it. And I'm like, fuck it. Sitting here at my table, I want to read it. Man, it looks fantastic, dude. And that's a little bit of Kevin O'Neill and him a little bit because I think it was a two-parter. I only read the first part. Oh, no, wait, was it?
It is a two-parter.
But I was also.
And they never collected it.
They never?
And they never colored it. That was my big thing, too.
Yeah, it was black and white.
I kept hoping that they would do a second DC volume of the. It's not an omnibus, but it's a deluxe edition. And I kept hoping they would collect some of those crossovers, and particularly the Savage Dragon one, because I wanted to see that in color. I didn't like the artwork in black and white, and it's never been colored, so it's not collected.
Because I got that, and then I was going to start reading the Martial Law.
I thought it'd be really interesting if you took Eric Larson's artwork and colored it in that Kevin O'Neill fashion with those like watercolor.
Yeah,
I think that'd be an interesting experiment.
Didn't he do something with Destroyer Duck too?
Yeah, that was a crossover as well. I don't think he drew that one though.
No, he didn't. Okay,
I want to say Frank Fosco did that one. The guy who did some stuff over at Megaton with him as well.
When we went to that convention, that last convention, I had bought this little mini pack of crossovers, and all those crossovers were in there. Mm. So I lucked out on that.
Yeah, that is cool.
Yeah.
My feeling is that Eric Larson and John Byrne are very similar. Somewhat stylistically, obviously, there's a strong John Byrne influence on Eric Larson's artwork. And Eric Larson had hired a fellow, I think his name was Todd Hughes, who did the Freak Force book, who was very much in the John Byrne mold. I would qualify him as one of the John Byrne clones, personally. And so I think that these are two guys that ought to be buddies, who should be like on the same wavelength, but they're just similar enough that their differences like send them repulsed away from one another. You know, it was like magnets. You know, they were too similar, and they just.
I knew a franking was coming.
Raven Perez writes, I think folks make these things out to be bigger than they are. Clearly, neither guy really super gives a shit anymore. Fans keep this alive in their hearts when the actual people involved have moved on years ago. And you know, I say that, and then you know, when Mac decided to retweet Eric Larson about my Peter David interview, Larson was like, "Fuck that guy! He's still talking about this shit." So you know, I think there's still some anger in their hearts to this day.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I don't think there was ever any love lost between Peter David and Eric Larson, but obviously Larson probably had a lot of love for John Byrne before his idol turned on him. And I'm sure there's still a lot of hurt over that too, where it's like, you know, you get into comics in part because you're inspired by somebody and then that person criticizes you and you know, you never quite get over that, I don't think. There's a reason why John Byrne's never produced an Image comic, you know? So let's see. Oh, so then Ryan Daly wrote, good thread, gentlemen. He was kind of freaked out because he logs on and there's all of a sudden all these responses in his Twitter feed, and it's because of me and Kyle Benning going back and forth about all that stuff. He writes, when I do think of Larson, I think of him as the guy who picked up an issue of Hulk right after McFarlane and Amazing Spider-Man after McFarlane, and in both cases, I liked Larson's work vastly more. I didn't like Larson as much on Spider-Man, honestly.
I liked him on Spider-Man.
I prefer Larson's work, but not as much on Spider-Man. I thought that the thing that Todd McFarlane did better than anybody was Spider-Man, and I also preferred his Hulk to
Larson's. McFarlane's Hulk was fantastic.
Yeah.
With that big brow and that you felt the size of him. I liked Eric Larson's too.
Yeah. I like his stuff. Like I said, I wasn't that into him in the time. I like his stuff a lot more now. I really enjoyed Eric Larson drawing Spawn. I thought that was a good combination of style and character. In general, though, I'd very much prefer to see Larson's work. I'm afraid. Sorry. You know.
No.
McFarlane, I was never that big of a McFarlane fan. So. Okay, the final one is from Dragonet.net. I'm right there with you on that in terms of preferring Larson over McFarlane. And I'm glad that we touched base with the Dragon fan guys, because there's two super hugely long running series of Image Comics, Savage Dragon and Spawn. The show is called Spawnometer. We're going to cover an issue of Spawn in every episode of Spawnometer. But every few months, we're going to have to touch base with Savage Dragon, especially once the ongoing gets started, because if we're looking at the history of Image Comics, you can't forget about Savage Dragon. It's just that we'll take spaces, we'll have gaps in between Savage Dragon episodes, but he's going to keep popping up again and again.
Oh, yeah, Savage Dragon.
It'll be a regular thing for us.
We could call it something like, you know, Just the Fin.
Of course.
Come on, baby. Let me just put the fin in just a little bit. Can it get its own stream? There's a lot of hate for Savage Dragon.
Yeah. Well, I think recently, too, because he's gone after Trump so much.
Really?
So yeah. These guys really latch onto that shit.
Fuck, yeah. They're coming at him fucking with both barrels. Did he ever do an Obama issue?
Yeah, he had Obama on the cover of several issues. Yeah. Savage Dragon officially endorsed Obama for his election.
Oh, wow. Nice. See, I respect someone like that. Like, his book really is, he is Savage Dragon. Like, it's his interpretation of what he is in that universe. Nobody else does it. I don't think McFarlane sees himself as Spawn.
Nah. I mean, obviously, there's elements of
him. I'm sure
there.
Layfield sees himself as fucking Shaft.
Kinda, yeah. I think so too. Yeah. That would explain a lot.
Yeah.
This is the All Father Odin, and you should be listening to Radio Free Asgard.
No, that's just not gonna work. Let's try this again.
This is the evil Loki, and if you hate Thor as much as I do, you should be.
Alright, let's just try one more thing.
Jane Foster here, and you should be... Risen.
All right, let's just keep this simple. Hello, everybody. My name is Tom Harris, and I do a podcast called Radio Free Asgard, which airs every Thursday over at radiofreeasgard.com. We cover the adventures of Thor, Hercules, and more from ancient times all the way up into the present day. We read old comics and make fun of them. I do ridiculous voices and generally make an ass of myself. So if that sounds fun to you, you should come join us, the only Thor podcast hosted by a true descendant of Odin, over at radiofreeasgard.com. And we'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Gene Hendricks. You may remember me from such shows as The Hammer Podcasts and The Quantum Cast. I'd like to tell you about some special shows that I'm doing with some of your favorite podcasters. These shows are all about the live-action versions of comic book characters, and I'm calling them...
Legends of the Superheroes!
In each episode, we'll be looking at a different TV show or movie featuring characters like...
Batman! Wonder Woman!
Dr. David Banner.
And let's not forget about the non-superheroes, such as...
Swamp Thing!
Captain William Buck Rogers.
And many more. Look for the Legends of the Superheroes specials under the Hammer Podcasts at twotruefreaks.com.
When you think of podcasts about religion, you probably think of this.
But at least one religion podcast sounds more like this.
I kick ass for the Lord!
Dorkness to Light is a relatively geeky production in which Alan and Emily discuss topics of faith, religion, and spirituality.
But we do so through the lens of pop culture, like movies, TV, and comic books, because we're nerds.
Our primary focus will be on Christianity, because that's what we know best. But all religious content is on the table.
Well, think about it, Scully, from vampirism to Catholicism.
This is an occasional cast, to be recorded and released as the mood strikes, with topics ranging from in-depth reviews to personal rants about some small aspect of theology or church history, because we're theological nerds.
If these topics interest you, check out dorknesstolight.blogspot.com for our more regular content.
Or dorknesstolight.tumblr.com for our more irregular content. Memes and puns, mostly. My bad.
Dorkness to Light.
Often irreverent, rarely sacrilegious.
This is a fan-produced, not-for-profit podcast. No copyright infringement is intended, and any use of copyrighted materials believed to be covered under fair use. If you don't agree, you can go straight to hell!